Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. My name's Lee.
And I'm Simon.
And it's very nice of you to join us again this week. This is quite amazing, really. We're doing consecutive episodes, not necessarily week by week, but bi-weekly at the moment. And it's actually, this is the third episode in 4 weeks. So we're doing all right.
Yeah.
I don't know
what else to say about it, really.
You're enthusiastic as ever. I'm really glad to see that my wonderful enthusiasm is rubbing off on you.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So anyway, before we get into the news and everything else, just want to talk about the Forensic Forecast Awards. And you've probably not heard of this because I've not really said very much about it up to this point. But I asked for nominations a few weeks ago and nominations flooded in. Now, if you look on the Forensic Forecast website, forensicforecast.com, there is a new blog entry on there. Well, it's not really new, it's a few days old now, showing all of the nominations. All you have to do is just pick your nominations, the people who you want to vote for. You can vote for one person per one entry per category, and email it to vote@forensicforecast.com. In fact, do it now. Pause the podcast, go vote, and come back, and then we'll discuss the news stories. So I think that's fantastic. What we're planning on doing is we're going to do a live video feed for the awards. We thought about this because our company got an award last Thursday night, and we were there, and we thought, well, this would be fantastic if we just dressed up in our tuxedos and bow ties. We stood in front of a camera and we actually did a proper award ceremony. Well, as formal and as proper as we, as two guys sitting in suits in a room somewhere, can get, I guess. But we're going to make
especially
an effort.
Especially when it's us.
We're going to make an effort of it. And hopefully, if we persist, this thing will get bigger every year. And finally, we'll actually have an audience.
We could have an audience this time around. It just might be one person or two.
Yeah. The cameraman. So, that's what we plan on doing. So, like I said, pause the podcast now, go and vote, and then come back and listen to some more. So, go on, pause it. All right, never mind. Just
okay. Are they back?
Well, I don't think they pressed pause in the first place.
They so, in the first place?
No.
If you're back, then can't believe you voted for them.
Don't say that. Oh, don't believe it. Anyway, we've got Lance Mueller on for the interview later on. It's quite a lengthy interview. I tried to cut down some of the stuff which I didn't think would be particularly relevant, but there wasn't really any. So I just had to leave the thing as a whole, pretty much. I hope you enjoy it, and if you know, if it's a bit too long for you, then that's fair enough. You can go away and vote instead. So
they could vote while listening to the interview.
They can, yeah. Good way to spend some quality time. So, moving on into the news. A company has managed to get itself into a little bit of trouble by performing an investigation on one of its employees, or former employees, and have been landed with a significant fine. This is superb. First of all, I just want to tell you a little bit about what happens over here with this law. Because if this kind of thing happened here, straight away it's a human rights offence, and the person would almost certainly, the individual would almost certainly be granted the right to sue over these people and would most likely win. Reading this article, however, it's on law.com, leaves me a bit puzzled as to what, you know, what happens over in the States, to be honest, because it says here that as long as you put something in the person's contract saying you will use their credentials to check their email, that to me, it's a bit like wiretapping, I suppose.
Well, yeah, it's, well, I don't really know how to describe it, to be honest. It just seems like it's not the right course of action to take, because someone's webmail is, well, the very nature of webmail is you can access it anywhere.
Yeah.
And so you might get access to something that someone's accessed at work. You might get access to all sorts of other things about the person that you have no right to know.
Well, there's a few different areas here, right? So let's back this up, okay? So, this company, they suspected this person who worked for them had been passing on trade secrets to a rival company. So, in that event, I would say, yep, fine, have a look at the computer, see what you can derive from that for an investigation, and we'll go from there. But this wasn't enough. They obviously went through all of the artifacts on the computer, found the username and password for this web-based email, and then logged in and checked through it. Now, if they hadn't gone that far, there is absolutely no problem with performing an analysis on a company computer, is there?
No, not at all.
A company computer is the property of the company, and if somebody leaves something on there, I mean, this is how it goes in the UK anyway. If somebody leaves personal items on that computer, that's unfortunate. They shouldn't really have done it.
Yep.
But so the artifacts, the stored web pages, the stored emails, everything, it is fair game. Now, you start entering usernames and passwords, and that causes a significant issue. Because, what are some of the things that they could actually intercept then, Simon? If they go in and have a look at this person's private webmail...
I guess it depends on what kind of webmail it is. If it's Google Mail, for example, when you log into that, unless you've disabled it, you've got an inbuilt chat function. And so people could even just pop up and start talking to you or whatever else. You can access all sorts of emails, basically anything someone might have done in their lifetime online, things to do with things they might have bought or sold, just any kind of personal information that really they wouldn't have otherwise known and may not necessarily have any issue knowing.
No. That's the key thing that I wanted to touch on, is that there are private, personal things which are communicated on email that a company doesn't necessarily need to know about. So, me, for example, right, my whole life, essentially, I manage via my Gmail account. So, I've got my calendars on there, Gmail say or Google saves all my chats from Google Talk. Obviously, it does the email. It does all kinds of different things, and we could be talking about absolutely anything on there. There could be emails which I've never opened at work, like you said, which contain things like your upcoming prostate exam or. Just anything. There could be anything in there.
Phone bills, all sorts of things.
Yeah, there's just any number of things. It's a violation of somebody's human rights, in my personal opinion. But it's reflected in our law as well, though. So it is surprising to me that the US legal system will allow people to do that as long as it's written into a contract. If that was written into a contract here, do you think, Simon, that it would be allowed, that would be a sustainable part of the contract?
No, just because something's in a contract here doesn't mean it's necessarily legally binding. It comes down to all sorts of things, including duress. It comes down to whether the contract term is fair. If the contract term is in fact a legal contract term, and all these things are taken into consideration. If a contract's written up and it includes in it things that are unethical or illegal or just downright unfair, then there's a possibility that the person won't have to be held to that contract at all.
Yeah. So, I hope that's useful to people in the States listening to this, because it, just something like that you wouldn't be allowed to do here at all, regardless of whether you had somebody sign a contract saying they were allowed to do it or not. People might sign something like that and even believe that to be the case, but once they, you know, if they feel like they've been wronged and they go to a solicitor, the solicitor will say you can challenge it because it's unfair.
Essentially, you have the law, you have human rights, and then underneath that, you have the contract.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the order in which it pretty much goes, as far as I can see. And it's got to really pass those two things first before you can be held to it.
Yeah. One thing that I found interesting in the article was that it says basically companies can feel free to put policies like this into these contracts, you know, terms like this into the contracts and whatnot, but it might not be in the company's best interests. Goes on to say that if you do this, you could be causing people, the right people, to not apply to you, to not want to work for you, and cause people even to leave who are loyal employees. Just... That makes sense to me. The other thing about this is that there was, a couple of weeks ago, there was a big hoo-ha on the internet about a local city office or something, I believe, in Texas. It might have been. Unfortunately, I can't remember exactly where it was. But they said, if you want to apply for a job with us, in order to pass, you know, the interview and relevant all the relevant inspections and stuff like that, you have to submit all of your usernames and passwords for stuff like MySpace, for Facebook, for your email, all the social networking sites and things like that. Now, I can tell you right off, if I went for a job interview and somebody said you have to do that, or you know, your credentials are up for grabs if you use them on our computers, then that's, to me, it's just wrong. And I'll tell them to go away and I'll find a different job.
Yeah. Well, essentially, if you have a choice between working for two places, one pays you a bit more but has some crazy terms in its contract, and one pays you less and has a sensible contract, you're going to go with the one that pays less, aren't you, really?
Yeah, I mean, it depends, doesn't it? You're not always going to take the low-paid job if something like this comes up. Some people might feel pressured to go ahead and take the job and just say, yeah, here you go, here's all my credentials.
Yeah. It's one of those things that comes down to a personal preference, really.
Yeah.
I'd rather keep my freedoms and my own things that are kind of personal to me, rather than make a bit more money.
No, I agree. And one final thing that I just want to say about this as well. Say, for example, that the company did get hold of your email credentials, let's say, through an investigation on the computer which you were using, and they then used that to access your webmail account. What is to stop them from sending, you know, one of these special messages to a competitor in your name from your own account, and then turning around and saying, hey, look at this. This email. You sent this on this day. And that's just a mess. That's a mess.
That was the other thing that came to mind for me, is that if someone can get into these accounts, they can, in a sense, control some of the things that happen and assume your identity. For even if it's just for a couple of minutes, they could frame you, they could set you up for something.
Yeah.
They could alienate you to some people.
Absolutely.
They could look through your email, see that you sent an email to some competitor and then send some really stinging, nasty email back so they never contact you again.
So, what it boils down to is my advice, sincerely, don't do this because you'll get into trouble. In this particular instance, this company was fined originally $400,000, or this person won $400,000 from their former employer in damages and cost. It was reduced on appeal, but that's still, it will be a lot of money, and it's not worth it at all to do, I don't think. So, moving on to the next story, the RIAA. They're an interesting bunch, aren't they?
They are.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about why they've made the news this week, Simon?
Okay, well, we know about the RIAA and the fact that they've relied on certain information before to essentially find out about file sharing from Media Century, I believe.
Yep.
And while in times past this hasn't exactly worked out too well for them sometimes, given that they've sent letters to printers and all sorts of things, there is another one to add to the list where they've actually sent a letter to someone essentially telling them that they're required in court over file sharing when they didn't actually own a computer.
Fantastic, isn't it?
I guess technically it's still possible to do that.
Well, yeah.
But how would they know?
Yeah. Mavis Roy from New Hampshire, like Simon said, was being pestered by the RIAA for downloading copyrighted material, and they working through Media Century, they tracked down this woman, and based on an IP address, they said that was coming from her address. Well, it's genius. Apart from the fact that, you know, if there's no computer there can't possibly be an IP address, can there?
Well, you'd assume not.
No,
you don't know if this person's got some sort of internet type of phone that came in something they didn't know what they were signing up for or whatever else.
Well,
you would assume if there's no computer, there wouldn't be a router or modem of any kind.
Well, yes, especially when your name is Mavis and, you know, I can't remember how old she was. She was like in her 70s or something like that, wasn't she, living alone?
Yeah, it'd be safe to assume there's not been any kind of internet connection there.
Yeah. Now, this is just one of the... This is the latest in a stream of problems which the RIAA have been facing with Media Century. Mostly because Media Century argued to not be an authorised investigator, which comes back to our favourite subject, doesn't it, Simon?
I'm sick of mentioning it, to be honest.
Oh, just wait! Just wait until we get Scott Moulton on. I'm gonna have him talk about that like nothing else. But anyway, it's debated that that Media Century are authorized investigators, meaning they don't have PI licenses for the necessary states in which they are operating. Now, I have a feeling that there's at least a couple of people who've just shut off and being quite annoyed now. Sorry, it had to be mentioned. It just seems to me that Media Century not just aren't authorised investigators, but they just don't seem to have an idea about what they're doing, and the investigations they are performing are completely off track.
Yeah, well, it could well... people who do this file sharing, you never really can be sure what they're doing. I mean, they could be using someone else's wireless network. I mean, not in this case, by the looks of it. But there could be IP spoofing. They could be doing one of a number of things that will lead someone who's looking at these things instantly to the wrong place.
Yep.
But sometimes you've got to double-check these things and figure out whether that information could possibly be accurate.
Yep. and it just seems as if they're not checking it adequately,
yeah,
which is leading to things like this. And so they have
well,
they've
it
had
could
to
well be a kind of automated system almost, like over here with speeding cameras and things like that. It's a picture's taken, an automatic fine is issued and posted to the address of the person that owns the car.
Yeah.
It's possible that someone could have nicked your car and then gone speeding around through a town, or someone else had been driving.
Yeah, but that's possible with a car, isn't it? If this is a house where there's no internet connection, then
yeah, it's like sending a speeding fine when there's been either no car at that house or owned by this person, or the car's been lying in pieces on the driveway when it happened.
Yeah. So it's just, it's ludicrous. I don't know. It's the RIAA, they're their own worst enemies, I think, really, using Media Sentry. I don't know why they just don't choose to find somebody who's a bit better at doing this, to be honest.
Because it's certainly need to reconsider it, because it will get to a point where if enough of these things come to light, then it won't be reliable at all enough for court.
No. Well, that's what you could argue now, even, isn't it? Mm. I mean, we've heard stories about them trying to sue printers connected to the internet because their IP address is tied to file sharing and, you know, dead people and houses which don't exist.
Yep.
And all kinds of stuff. And this is just the latest one. And so I would just argue that their evidence collecting techniques are flawed. But yeah. Try telling that to Jamie Thomas or whatever her name was. $2 million almost. That's insane. But anyway. On to more silliness. And a man has been charged in Tennessee for virtual porn. Now, in this particular example, this man, by the name of Michael Campbell, three pictures on his computer. No actual indecent pictures of children or child porn, but three pictures in which there are naked female bodies that are over the age of 18, but in each case he has used Photoshop or GIMP or something like that, and put the head of three children, the heads of three children on each of these bodies. Two from his local town and one from Miley Cyrus. So, the question is, Simon, what is this?
You know, this is one of these things that it really does depend on who you ask. And it depends on all sorts of circumstances, I guess. I think, personally, it could be a bit ridiculous to try and charge someone over just that. But at the same time, you can see some reasoning behind it, especially if it involves the faces of local people.
Absolutely.
So it really does depend on the context of all of this, and it depends on whether there's a million different factors for things like this. And to say someone stuck the head of Miley Cyrus on someone else's body, therefore they're guilty of making child pornography is a bit crazy.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that these pictures, the reason people get charged for these pictures, for indecent pictures of children and everything else, is because they are pictures of child abuse. That's the main reason, isn't it? Now, if you take pictures of a child being abused, whether it's just nudity, whether it's something more serious, it's abuse, and I'll accept that, okay? But in this certain instance, tell me who was abused.
Well, by the looks of it, no one. And we've discussed this fairly recently before, in recent podcasts, haven't we? At least I think we have. I don't remember anymore. But I seem to remember us discussing a similar issue, possibly involving cartoons or something of the ilk.
Yes.
About how there is no real abuse, therefore how can it really be an offence?
Yes. Now, obviously, like you said, there is cause for concern here, because two of the girls whose heads he'd supplanted onto these nude bodies were a local 10-year-old and 12-year-old girl. So, there's obviously something needs to be done with him.
Yeah, I don't know if arresting the guy and trying to charge him for making indecent images is really the right way to go in this instance.
Well, especially if they're the only three things on his computer. I can understand those being contributing factors to something if he'd had hundreds and hundreds of indecent pictures on there. But that doesn't appear to have been the case. So we are seeing quite a lot of stuff like this happening, though, aren't we? Where I know that we have seen an increase in this country specifically, where you'll get a case and it'll be obviously abusive images. But when you start the investigation, you'll probably get one or two, and the technique that typically don't tend to really charge people sufficiently. They'll let them off with a warning unless there is a, you know, I think it's 15, is that right? 15 indecent pictures
possibly.
Of children. But then we'll also see lots of what's become known as virtual porn, where you'll have 3D renderings of people who look like they are children. Mm-hmm. In sexual acts with people who look like adults. But, I mean, it becomes very, very tricky here, doesn't it?
I suppose it's to do with the mindset as much as anything else of the person looking at these things or creating these things. It's almost as if it's a case of preempting them moving on to from what they're looking at to something that is actually illegal. And so they're kind of getting in there and charging them early. But I don't know if that... It's like punishing someone for something they haven't done yet, almost.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like that Tom Cruise film, Minority Report. Mm. People getting arrested before they've actually committed the crime. But it's all very, very hazy, and I wouldn't like to be the person to stand up and say, yes, we need to charge the person for this. I mean, like you said, there was a case in Australia as well about The Simpsons, mm-hmm. where this guy, he once again didn't have anything on his computer which even got close to indecent pictures of children. But what he had was pictures of Bart, Lisa, and Maggie engaged in sexual activity from The Simpsons. And you think, well, that's just part and parcel of something which you might find in an investigation every day. But in Australia, this guy was charged, sentenced, he appealed in December, and the judge upheld the original decision. Now, the guy wasn't sent to prison in this particular case. He was fined $3,000, which is like $2,000. And probably by the time anyone listens to this, it could be like £5 million. But it's just craziness. If these are the only things which these people have, there must be a better solution than charging them and trying to drag them through the court system.
Yeah, the issue is it comes down to law, doesn't it? And the idea of going, getting so carried away in creating laws that kind of minimise things that you lose sight of what you created the laws for in the first place. And the laws were created and have been used to essentially combat child abuse. And we've got to a point now where it's going beyond that to looking at people's mindset and trying to figure out whether someone might actually look at some kind of evidence of this, I suppose. And it's not really, it's kind of a bit far removed from what the original thing was.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's two things really that come out of this. First of all, I don't necessarily agree that that's a good thing anyway. Trying to identify what somebody's mindset was, because that just
you can
not,
never prove that.
No,
ever.
It that's a very, very crazy thing to do. And the second thing is that the law is made to protect people, and we said this earlier on. The law is there to protect. Who is the law protecting in these instances? In the case of Bart, Maggie and Lisa, they are not real people. They do not need to be protected from anything. In this case of this man in Tennessee, nothing's happened. You know, there's no physical abuse, no mental abuse, no emotional abuse has taken place. Therefore, why does this man need to be arrested and charged? Because like I said, the law's there to protect, and it doesn't need to protect anybody yet.
No one is in
any immediate danger.
But the thing is, you mentioned the word "yet" in there, and
well, but that's it. You can't arrest somebody for something that they might do.
No, and this is the thing is. Should cases like this come to light, there's other things that can be done that don't go as far as what is currently being done. And if you think someone might be in danger of progressing from what they're looking at to something more serious, then give them cautions, provide counselling for them, or do something that's going to see if you can turn things around before they get any further, rather than just try and throw the legal system at them.
I mean, I think it's kind of bad, really, because these people now, they're branded paedophiles for basically the rest of their lives, and
yeah.
I'm not convinced that they've done anything which is necessarily unlawful. It might be a bit, you know, in this Tennessee guy's example, it might be a bit sick, and he might need to be psychologically evaluated and then go from there, but take that route. Don't arrest the guy and call it, you know, basically have his name and his picture splashed all over the news.
Yeah. Well, surely that route, the idea of getting him essentially looked at, for want of probably a better word, it's surely got to be cheaper than going through the legal system for it.
Absolutely.
And paying the costs of lawyers and whoever else might be involved.
Well, just as a side note, in this Simpsons case, it was upheld that Maggie, Bart, and Lisa were people, and that's why they were able to charge this guy and uphold this this original ruling.
Which now begs a question of its own, doesn't it? I mean, that's something on its own to be challenged in court. You've got to say, okay, show me their birth certificate. Show me their, show me a social security number. show me something that proves that they are a real person.
Well, if I draw a picture of one of them, and then I tear up the piece of paper, do I then get done for murder?
if you think along the same lines, and if you follow those same lines, and I suppose the answer should
no.
ludicrously be
no, well, it won't be. But it, I obviously like to take things to extremes.
No, but it's the same podcast, basic logic, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
and you can't apply logic to one thing and not to another. Well, it's got to apply across the board, really, and things have got to make sense.
all I know is if they started charging people for that kind of behaviour and arresting them over here in the UK for swapping heads, then that's one thing, I suppose. But then the Simpsons porn, if people start getting charged for that, I tell you that our prisons would be even more overcrowded than they are now.
Yeah, the kind of things that people send in messages to one another all over the place, and a large majority of the phones that we examine would have something along these lines on it.
Almost every computer I look at has got some kind of Simpsons or, you know, Family Guy porn or something like that. It's just, unfortunately, in this day and age, it's the norm. It's just bizarre. But
yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to the next thing to rant about, shall we?
All right.
This is brilliant, this. You know, I know there's a lot.
I think I know which one you're going to.
I know most people in the States, they listen to this podcast. You know, you guys are going to see a distinct difference in some of the things which we do here and some of the things which you do over there. And this last week, a US Supreme Court ruling said that crime lab analysts had to appear in court for cross-examination if they submit something as evidence, regardless of whether they're called, you know, whether the evidence is in dispute or anything like that. It's called the Confrontation Clause from the Sixth Amendment. And what happened is that there was a ruling in the Melendez-Diaz, Massachusetts case, and it was voted by the judges 5-4. Now, what essentially this means now, what's happened is that, just backing up slightly, there's been a number of cases in the past where drugs have been sent off for processing and for analysis. People have said, yes, these are drugs, and they've supplied a certificate, basically, of authentication, saying, yes, these are, you know, these are illegal narcotics. And so, fair enough. Now, what these judges are saying is that the Confrontation Clause means that even though you might do, you know, I don't know, 20 of these tests a week and supplying these certificates, every single time you do that, you are going to have to appear in court to face the person who is accused of the crime so that they can challenge you. Now, I'm worried here, and I think that a lot of people should be worried about this. I'm not worried because I think this will happen over here, because I don't see it. What's happened is that this has become pretty much the norm, hasn't it, these days, for digital forensics, is that you supply your report, whether it's for a phone or a computer or some other device, and that goes to court. People will either dispute it or they won't. If it's not disputed, that's fair enough. Now, I have a feeling here this is going to affect prosecutions more than defences. So if we transpose this ever so slightly, okay, Simon, how many phones do you do in a week?
Well, I personally don't do very many, but
all right. Well, on average,
the average person will do between 2 and 4 phones a day, depending on the complexity of them.
Okay, so that adds up to, let's take the high end of that. That'll be 20 phones a week.
Mm-hmm.
Times that by 4, and you've got, well, for a month, you've got anywhere between 80 and 100 phones. Yes?
Yep.
So, potentially, a phone examiner could do around about 5,000 cases a year.
Yeah.
You agree with that, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unlikely, but let's just use that as an example, okay?
On a year full of good days.
On a year full of good days.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, at the low end, it will probably be knocking around the 2,000 mark. Mm-hmm. So, where does the phone analyst find the time to go to court and defend their findings for all of these cases?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer for it.
No, it's impossible. And I can guarantee that these places do not have the sufficient resources in order to keep sending people out, nor the time, neither do the courts have the time in order to do this. I know it's part of the law, it's constitutional, but surely they've got to interpret this slightly differently.
You can interpret it in the manner of it discussing witnesses to a crime, or you can interpret it regarding witnesses of fact or expert witnesses or anyone who has any association.
Yeah.
And it becomes a bit infeasible when you look at it from the point of view that something that could easily be taken as fact, evidence that could be agreed by both parties, could still be subjected to cross-examination, which seems a bit pointless.
No. Well, exactly. It is... The thing which gets me is that I don't know exactly when this clause came in, so forgive me if I'm incorrect here. But I'm going to imagine this clause came in back before people travelled great distances to attend court hearings and the like, where the average crime was if somebody stole a horse or something like that, or shot somebody in a local town, and they were then taken to court, and the person was there in the town to give that report. What happens these days is that evidence is sent, in some cases, thousands of miles in order to get examined, whether it's drugs, whether it's some kind of other evidence, whether it's digital evidence. Where do these people find the resources, the time, the money, in order to go out and defend their actions to somebody who probably knows that they're telling the truth in the first place?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think you can look at it and you can say that even if the court was very local and you had a lot of work to do in forensics, it would still be all of your time going back and forth in to court cases. So the distance just sort of compounds that, really. If it's not a court that's on your doorstep.
No. I don't know. This is something, like I said, it really, really concerns me. I'd like to hear what other people think about this as well. Understanding that it is constitutional and that it probably should have been practiced like this up to now, somehow things have deviated away from this and these judges are trying to reel it back in. But are they doing the right thing? Just let us know. Comment on the podcast or send an email or something like that. I really, really want to know what people's feelings are about this. Especially those people in law enforcement, because like I said, I think these are the people who are going to be affected by this the most. Defense examiners are most likely to already have in their minds, I'm going to court anyway because I'm a defense expert. That's just part and parcel. But say for people who, like you, Simon, who do all these phones and send them off all the time, those are the people that I'm really, really concerned about, not to mention the amount of money that will be spent from the taxpayers on shifting these people around the country to various places to uphold their part of the legal system.
Yeah, it becomes quite timely, quite expensive, and you just look at it and you just think that there's no way that can really work.
No.
Not in the way that has been suggested recently.
No, I think it is quite quite crazy. But like I said, I want people to tell us exactly what they think about this, and just let us know, and we'll probably talk about it a little bit more in depth another time when we've heard more back from people. So yeah, that's, I think on that note, we'll finish with the news. Now, I had the pleasure of talking to Lance Mueller just over a week ago, and recorded an interview with him. He was down in Mexico doing some training at the time, and we just wanted to have a little chat with him. Like I said, this interview is almost an hour long, but I think it's well worth it because he talked about some interesting things. So please go on, listen to it, and join us afterwards. And Simon's going to share with us a funny little story at the end. Hi, we've got Lance Mueller joining us today for our interview. Hi, Lance, how are you doing?
Great. Hello. How are you?
All right, not too bad. Lance is joining us from Mexico today, which is one of the many places he could have chosen to talk to us from. He's a very, very busy man, and we're very happy to have him on the show today.
So, I really appreciate you having me.
No problems at all. All right, well, I don't know how many people have heard of you before.
I think just two, you and maybe my business partner.
But you're quite well known in the field. Why don't you tell us exactly how you got into the field and some of the things which you're doing at the moment?
Sure. So my career really started back in law enforcement, and about 1989, I entered the law enforcement field. And computers back then were kind of my hobby, and you know, we were just getting into the desktop, the AT series of desktops. I certainly had, you know, the previous models of Apples and TRS-80s before, but we just kind of evolved into the desktop, you know, 40 meg hard drive, that kind of stuff, whopping hard drives. So it was my hobby. I started my career in law enforcement and was doing that pretty much, you know, during the day and kind of messing around with computers at night. I used to run a bulletin board called Abort, Retry, and Fail. You know, I thought it was great. At one time I had three dial-in phone numbers, and, you know, I would get all excited as soon as one phone rings. So that was kind of my hobby. And then in about 93, 94, we started seeing investigations come in where, you know, suddenly there was this desktop device, you know, this huge desktop that was involved somehow, whether it be because it had some accounting information or financial information. So my career, my hobby kind of intersected. And I couldn't be any happier. I was, you know, suddenly now being able to explore the things that I was learning at night at home at work. So I was in the Detective Bureau doing investigations and starting to see more and more computers. And of course, back then there wasn't many forensic tools. We were doing everything obviously by DOS. And so that's pretty much how it started. And ever since then, I pretty much stayed in computer forensics. I did other ancillary duties with the law enforcement side, but I always stayed at least with one foot, or sometimes one foot and one arm in it, trying to do as much as I could. And when they tried to pull me out, I held on for dear life, saying, no, I don't want to go anywhere else. So eventually I ended up in a task force, a Secret Service task force in LA, back, you know, again, early part of 2000, when task forces were starting to be born, and doing investigations and managing the forensic lab, the forensic cases that were being brought into the lab. And so I left law enforcement in about 2004. I had been doing some part-time teaching for guidance. I started using InCase in the early 2000s, actually 99, version 199L was my first official version, although I had played around with Expert Witness a bit before that. But so I had gone to some guidance training, and then and then quickly got picked up or asked to be a part-time instructor by them back in the early 2000s. So I was doing some part-time instruction for them as well as working at the lab. And then finally, you know, I decided to leave law enforcement and left full-time and went to guidance full-time as an instructor. I did some course development. Back then, they didn't have the network intrusion. I put together the network intrusion class, the NTFS class, the inscripting class, and then moved to a couple of different divisions inside of guidance as it was growing. When I joined, there was about 45 employees. So they're about tenfold now. There are about 450 employees.
Yep.
So I stayed with them for a couple of years. And I left full-time with them about a year and a half ago and decided to kind of go off on my own, start a company with a partner of mine named Michael Weber. And so that was when we formed the company called BitSec Forensics. And today that's pretty much what we do. It's a full-service consultancy where we primarily focus on two areas, training and then also forensic consultancy. Network security, as well as, you know, traditional forensic, e-discovery, cell phones, and such. Both of us, how I met Mike, he was in law enforcement on the east coast of the U.S. in Maine, assigned to a task force. And we had seen each other's names and such, you know, growing up in the forensic community, it's pretty small. Once you've been around for a little bit, you start to hear names and seeing them on list servers. So we had seen each other's names, but we'd really never met. We were both doing some contract work with the U.S. State Department, and finally our paths intersected, and we started doing some work together with the State Department. So we continue to do that. We now contract with the State Department through our company as part of the anti-terrorism initiative, where we help train foreign countries in cyber investigations. So between the two of us, through ATA or through the State Department, we've each been to about 30 different countries, doing cyber training, either providing or putting together, you know, basics or advanced level training for that country, or installing labs, granting equipment, and getting them up to speed as far as where we are in the cyber world. So that pretty much leads me to today, where, as you mentioned, I'm in Mexico City doing some training with the government here.
Very cool. Well, something that how long ago did you say it was? You left guidance about a year and a half, yeah? Thereabouts.
Okay, a year and a half. I started BitSec Forensics.
Yeah.
We've been going for about a year and a half now. About January last year is when we officially kicked it off as an official company.
And you're now based in both Bangkok and California, is that correct?
Yeah, we actually, the corporate headquarters is in Maine. That's where Mike is located. So we have an office there, an official office. We have a presence in D.C. We have an office in California, which is where I was based. And I have since now moved to Bangkok, Thailand, where, again, you know, on paper, that's where I live. But as you mentioned, I do travel quite a bit. So, you know, I'm pretty much on the road about 330 days out of the year. So I do have a home there, and that's where I return to when I have my downtime. And the purpose of going there was really to try to help develop some of the market in that area. They're a couple of years behind us as far as the industry. So they're ripe for, you know, training, and they're hungry for training because they're just now getting their feet wet. Kind of figure where we were 5-6 years ago. That's about where they are. So there's quite a bit of training opportunities, quite a bit of business opportunities there. So we decided to open an office there, and I bit the bullet and moved there.
Fantastic. Obviously, your time with guidance prepared you quite a lot for what you currently do as well. You're very well known for writing end scripts and the like. Probably, I mean, that's the thing I would think of you more for at the moment, that, and also whenever I go on an NCASE course, I still see, whenever they got evidence files and stuff, I always see Lance Mueller account on one of these evidence files and stuff, so.
Yeah, I've seen leave my mark, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but I've left my mark a few places.
So, yeah, so how long have you been doing Enscripts for, and what do you think is probably the masterpiece that you've created so far?
So I got into I'm not a programmer by profession, certainly. Computers were always my hobby, as I said. When I was working at the Secret Service Lab, we were obviously trying to find a way to expedite and automate processes. And so no one really knew inscripting, and at the time I was not working for guidance yet, but then as soon as I started working part-time, I had access to, you know, the kind of the inscripting, not really the manual, because they really didn't have one for quite a while, but at least some internal documents about it.
Yeah.
And I decided, look, you know, I need to learn this. It's one day I'll have to train it or teach it. And once I started learning it, I decided, look, this is really an untapped feature where people, I don't think people realize the power and the potential of this. So I decided, you know, pretty much to teach myself, which I did. And certainly once I went to full-time with guidance, it helped because I was really immersed in it. And then developing the inscripting course, which was a one-week course, and then it now since developed into a two-week course. You know, I think I really got into it then, and I really enjoy writing them with the blog that I have. I started that blog kind of as a way to share some of the inscripts I have, because I really don't, if you search the internet, there's really not a lot out there. There's a lot of inscripts out there, but they're not really publicly accessible. A lot of people have their own. They don't, you know, they keep them internal because someone internal wrote them, or they don't mind sharing, but there's really no central repository for them.
Yeah.
So I decided to kind of create a blog to start sharing the ones that I had written in classes, or, you know, back, as I said, in the early 2000s, when I'd be in a class and someone would say, it would be really neat to write an inscript or have an inscript for this. You know, 2 days into the course, I'd try to write it and give it to them. And then I'd have this inscript that was useful to one person, but not necessarily to me, but at least to one person. And I figured, well, if it's useful to one person, then it's probably useful to someone else. So I'll start posting them. That's pretty much how it evolved. And, you know, since then, you know, I've written probably a couple hundred inscripts for people. I do them for free if they're, you know, a simple, easy one that I can do during my time. You know, I pretty much, that's my pastime when I'm riding planes, flying on planes and being there trying to write an inscript or put something together. As far as the best inscript, I don't know. You know, my blog has been in place now for about 3 years, and it's kind of grown every year. This last year, from June of last year till June of this year, I've had 50,000 unique hits.
Holy cow.
I average about 400 a day, you know, maybe 4,000, 5,000 a month, depending on, you know, each month is kind of cycles up and down depending on how much I post. But the top hit, believe it or not, the top page, the top blog posting have been about bypassing Windows passwords that I posted maybe about a year and a half ago. It's not really an inscript. It's really more about the mechanics of how to get around Windows password when you're doing forensics and you want to look at it virtually in a virtual machine, but there's a password and you want to just get by it real quick. And then the second most popular post has been a post I did about 7 months ago on cell phones, where I posted about 5 different cell phone products that I had evaluated as part of our training course. And I kind of just posted some random thoughts as far as my notes, as far as, you know, which tools seem to work better than others. And I've gotten so many hits on, so many questions about that, and so much feedback on that particular post. And then inscript specific, the USB inscript, the one that goes and kind of looks at the USB mount points and such, and gives a kind of a report of what kind of removable devices have been attached. That came about is I came across a tool from Nearsoft, which, you know, reports on USB devices that have been attached to a live computer.
Yeah.
And so I just did a little research on it and figured out what, you know, where it's looking, of course, around that time was also Harlan Carvey's book was coming out and was posting some information about doing an analysis on registry regarding removable drives. So what I did is I just kind of picked as much information I could out of the different sources and decided to just write an InScript that kind of just kicks out a report of all this. And that has probably been the most, in the long term, the most downloaded, the most hit InScript on the web, on the blog. I posted one about 4 months ago. It was a project that I did with the Maine State Police, the task force there. Sergeant Glenn Lang, he's the commander of the ICAF task force there. He was looking for a way to search for child pornography, doing better quick assessments in child porn cases. And we had kicked around some ideas about, you know, hashing, and that's kind of the traditional way, but it's kind of time-consuming. So we had decided to put together an InScript where he was going to start collecting a fixed byte string from known bad child pornography images. So instead of hashing the whole image, he was extracting basically a 10-byte value from the middle of each photograph or each video, and then keeping that kind of in a database. So what I did is I wrote an InScript to basically read that database, which can be a text file, which most people, that's the way most people run it, is they just sucks up a text file with these signatures in them, these 10-byte signatures, and then searches the evidence for these files. The thing that makes it so fast and so accurate is that it doesn't have to hash the whole file. It doesn't even have to search through the whole file. Because the 10-byte signature is pulled from a specific location, an offset, if you think about it, a way a file is laid out along clusters, then you can actually hop clusters and not search the entire cluster. You can just go to a specific point in a cluster, look for that 10-byte string. If it's not there, you go to the next cluster. So you're ending up, you know, in an average Windows file system, you know, 4,096 bytes per cluster. You're skipping essentially 4,086 bytes worth of searching for every 10 bytes that you want to search. So suddenly now, you know, something that took a day or 2 days to search through looking for all this child porn via hash analysis is taking 2 hours because, you know, you're essentially cutting down the amount of space that you have to search. So that's been the most popular in the last, you know, 4 or 5 months. I predict that one will probably exceed the USB one given the same time period.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, that I've read about that, and it does seem as if that potentially could have quite a significant impact, I think, because, I mean, it's not just the allocated stuff that you're looking for these chunks of the file in either, is it? Because the disk structure maintains even through unallocated space, that even the clusters there, you would just skip through unallocated space extremely quickly to find that data from that picture.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it originally was intended and written to search unallocated, although it's developed into the entire file system. But think of a book. A book is split into chapters. You think of those chapters as clusters. Then instead of searching the whole entire book, what you're doing is you're skipping chapter to chapter, looking at a specific page in that chapter. And once you've looked in that page, there's no reason to look at the rest of the pages in that chapter. Just go to the next chapter. Look in that specific page. If it's there, great, make a hit. If it's not, skip to the next chapter. So instead of searching 500 pages of a book, now you're searching essentially 5 chapters and only 1 page in each chapter. So suddenly, you know, you're dividing by this number that reduces it by 100-fold, sometimes even greater than that. So it speeds it up. So the downside is, you know, you have to have a known database of these signatures, which Glenn has done a really good job at maintaining, because he's in an ICAC task force. They do see a lot of it, so they've been maintaining a pretty good database, and they're sharing it. So anybody who wants it, I've linked it off the blog, but they certainly can contact Glenn Lang at the Maine State Police laboratory, and he shares that with anyone so that they can take use of that same technology.
Superb. That's the one thing that I really like about this particular field, is that people are very willing to share the knowledge which they have already. And
yeah.
I think you've gone above and beyond with sharing the end scripts. Like, there's a lot of people who would either retain them themselves or charge or whatever else, but it's good to see that someone is not just anybody, but you know, the person who probably writes more end scripts than anyone else on the planet has said, here you go, here's something which helps you with your investigations. And I think that I just think it's worth a mention, to be honest, because it's...
Yeah, I've tried to, you know, as I mentioned, if it's a really simple end script, you know, if it takes me a couple hours to put together, if someone comes to me and I get a lot of email off the blog where someone will say, look, I think this would be a really good end script, I'll kind of evaluate it and go, yeah, okay, I may not use that, but it does sound useful, and obviously one person asked me for it, so I'll go ahead and write it and post it on the blog. Usually, if someone asks me to write an end script, I'll write it, and the only stipulation is, I get to post it, meaning if I wrote it, I'll post it on the blog and everybody can share.
Yeah.
If it's an involved or a custom end script or somebody wants to keep it internal, then that's usually where I'll end up charging. We'll do it as a consultant on an hourly rate, where someone wants to create an end script and keep it as internal to their corporation. So we signed NDAs and we write out a contract and say, okay, look, you know, what's the specifications that you want? We'll write it. And then those are the ones we don't post. And they'll still stay internal to the company that, you know, hired us to write them. But for the most part, as I said, most of the inquiries that I get are pretty easy. You know, it takes, you know, maybe an hour, 2 hours of my time, something to kill during, flights. And as I said, it really, you know, there's a lot of blogs out there. There's a lot of resources out there that I rely on that they provide for free. So this is, you know, this has always been my way of kind of giving back, to saying there's no reason to charge for this. There's so many things I get out of all these other websites. Then if I can't give back in that way, I can at least give back in the InScript way and help other people out and try to expedite their work. Right. I mean, the end goal is really to try to streamline and have a better workflow and, put more people in jail and, you know, find the evidence faster.
Yeah, very cool. What would you say is how your time is divided now between things like, let's say, EndScript programming, providing training courses, and actually going out and doing the forensic analysis? What time split do you have there, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say I still keep myself very busy with normal forensics. My expertise has always been in network intrusions. When I was at the Secret Service Laboratory, that's pretty much what I did. So that's always been kind of my forte. So when we get those kind of cases, those are typically the ones I take, or at least initially head up and then hand off to someone else to kind of mentor or at least oversee. So I would say that, you know, out of a year, I'm probably in a 60-40, 60 training, 40 actually doing forensics. And then the InScript part is kind of filtered in throughout the year whenever I have time. Weekends, like now I'm in Mexico City, I have the weekend free. You know, I'll do my work that I need to do, and then I'll bang out a few InScripts here and there for either internal use or people that have requested things on the blog. Paid InScripts, those vary, but sometimes we'll go, you know, 2-3 months with no requests, and then suddenly we'll have a month and we'll have 2 or 3 requests. So that's pretty cyclic. It really depends on, you know, what people need at the time. Certainly as InCase comes out with new versions, that's usually a spike, because either guidance hasn't caught up with their InScript development. So for example, the case processor InScript, which is kind of the, you know, the MOAB, you know, low-hanging fruit. Someone runs that to get kind of the general information about the evidence.
Yep.
That didn't support Vista for quite a while after Vista came out. So I get those requests right away. Hey, I've got, you know, InCase version 6, but it doesn't support Vista. Can you write an InScript for that? So I do see spikes in releases of Incase, major releases of Incase. And then also minor releases sometimes break things, so then I see spikes in that as well, where someone had a custom inscript written by someone else or even from guidance, and suddenly it's broken and they have a case and they need it really quick. If I've got the free time, if I've got some downtime, then I try to throw something together, you know, as my free time avails. I guess you'd look at it as, you know, all of us work in this field and we probably do this, you know, 23 hours out of the day, forensic, and many people have hobbies. This is kind of my hobby. I guess it's my way. It's my creative side, I guess, where it's kind of therapy for me to sit down and write an inscript and do something kind of fun and, you know, put something together that helps other people. That's great.
Very cool. Going back to the network intrusion cases that you work on, if you were to give advice to somebody who they think that they have a client that's come to them and said, we think we've been hacked or whatever else, what would you do at that point? What advice, recommendations would you give to them?
Well, each case is going to vary, obviously. I guess the biggest thing that we try to stress in our training, even at the guidance training that when I developed that course, is really the first step has got to be information gathering, right? I mean, it's one thing to listen to an admin saying, look, I've been hacked and I, you know, this one machine, but you write that down in your notes and then you draw a huge box around that and say, okay, I need to get outside this box. Let's not just look at this one machine or this one, you know, the administrator thinks this is the one way. Let's first spend an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours and really discuss the environment. What are all the potential possibilities here? Because too many times I've seen where, again, an administrator or someone internal says, look, we've been hacked. This is a public-facing server, and we think they got in this way. And the police go marching off down that road only to find out that they back up and go down a different road. So it just saves time to really stop and say, okay, let's really learn about the environment first. In other words, you know, tell me everything there is about the infrastructure. How is it laid out? What's your network look like? What kind of machines do you have? What are all your public-facing machines? You know, this is the one that you confirmed as hacked, but tell me everything else that is out there in the DMZ. Tell me everything else that is potentially exposed. What are all the other ways into your network? You know, what do you do with contractors? Do they have ways in? Is there VPN access? All those ways, because naturally, and the majority is correct, naturally the thing is to look at is the internet, but that's not always the case. I mean, there's been many articles published that the threat is from within, and typically it's an insider. Most of the cases I've done have always been an outsider, not an insider. But from an overall average, I think there's been, you know, disgruntled employees that have been let go, contractors, et cetera, that have access, and the access remains, and they suddenly take advantage of that. So I would say that, you know, if a person calls and says, you know, I think I've been hacked, the first step I try to do, or at least I recommend, is let's sit down and really learn about the environment, what kind of infrastructure they have. Tell me everything about their internal network system, the operating systems, their patch levels, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, then it really depends on the type of breach, but typically we end up doing, a pretty detailed forensics on the one machine, right? So the administrator calls and says, there's this one machine that has files on it that we don't recognize, so we think we've been hacked. Then typically you're going to have to do some sort of level of forensics on that machine. Maybe not a deep, what we call a deep dive forensics, where you're spending days, but you're going to have to do a triage on that machine. You're going to have to look for artifacts or potential indicators of the behavior of the attackers, so you can use that as a search criteria. So you take those indicators and then turn it around and look at other machines to help identify other machines that might be involved in the incident. Because for the most time, you know, attackers are creatures of habit. They like their tools. In fact, many times we've seen investigations where we've assumed or we've gathered intelligence from looking at the artifacts and said to ourselves, we think there's two attackers because, you know, we have five or six boxes that have been compromised, and they all have the same tools on them. And then we have another five or six that have kind of slightly different tools. We all have our tools that are favorites, and attackers are no different. So you start to see the toolbox that a particular attacker carries along, even though they're associates and they're working together, their styles are different.
It's like a signature, so to speak.
Exactly, exactly. So what we've really tried to develop is tools and ways to, since you do an investigation, look at a box and say, okay, here are the things we can attribute to a bad guy. Those things might be a file, they might be a permission on a file, they might be a name of a file, a hash of a file, a date and time. And taking that criteria, punching it into an inscript, and then say, go fetch. Go find me all the other machines out there in the world, meaning the environment that that particular company has, and tell me all the other machines that have the same behavioral artifacts on them, whether they be files present, certain directories that might exist, certain metadata on those directories, created times, modified times, permissions on files. Those are all criteria that we use to help search and find other machines. The end goal is, it really depends on the client. Some clients just want to know how big and how bad. How big and how bad have we been compromised? They don't really care about the path. They just want to know how bad is this and is our PII exposed. Others want to know the full extent. So for that, what you're trying to do is latch on. I mean, if you think of a forest and you think of a breadcrumb trail leading through a forest, your goal as an examiner is to find that one breadcrumb. You don't care which one. Find one and use that to look to the right and left and find the next one and then the next one. And then ultimately the goal is, what was the direction? Where did they come from? Where were they going to? What was their method of entry and what was their goal? What was their motive? What were they eventually looking for? Many times it's just exploring, and through exploring they find devices of value. But other times, in other cases I've worked on, it's absolutely obvious that someone has broken in and they're looking for something extremely particular, finance machines, database servers that hold PII. I mean, it's quite obvious they leave everything else alone and they're going right for the crown jewels. So you're trying to kind of rebuild a story. Again, I use the analogy of a 1,000-piece puzzle that you buy from the store. We all cheat, we all look at the box and, help us put together the puzzle. Well, your goal in a network intrusion is really to find as many pieces of the puzzle. You will never find them all because some of them are not recorded. But your goal is really to find as many pieces of that puzzle so you can at least see an outline of what the puzzle looks like so that you can at least report back to your client and say, okay, this is what the story tells us. This is what their activity can tell us. This is their direction. This is their method of entry, which helps, identify, is there need for different policies? Is there need for hardening their network security? Is there some sort of deficiency there? What's their incident response procedures? Is there any kind of faultiness in that that needs to be addressed? Your goal really is to try to tell a story of what happened, and the rest is really dependent on the client, what they want. Sometimes they, like I said, they just want to know, is my PII safe? If it's safe, they don't care about anything else. They don't want to know. They patch the hole and go on. Others want to know the full extent, and even if their PII is not, they want to carry it all the way through and see every machine, just make sure that it's clean and there's nothing else lurking around, no hidden back doors that the intruder can get back in on.
Yeah. It sounds fantastic. I mean, I went on the incident, the network intrusion course at Guidance just a couple of weeks ago, and obviously things have changed somewhat since you originally wrote that course. And yeah, to me, it's amazing that you can, especially in like an enterprise environment where someone can go in and just know what to look for. Essentially, straight off, the knowledge you must have to do that is pretty vast for all the malware which is out there, really.
Well, when I wrote that course in you know, you went through it just recently. One of the first modules and principles talks about the mindset of an attacker. It's impossible to teach anyone. It's impossible for me to know all the different vulnerabilities and all the different exploits that are out there. So it's impossible. There's too many of them every day that come out. So you really got to back up and go, okay, there's really a method to this, right? I mean, it really doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a PHP exploit or it's a buffer overflow or if it's a Unicode, you know, type exploit. Ultimately, the process is the same. You know, the technical details of how they got in might differ, but the process is the same. So don't focus too much on knowing exactly which exploit, but more so look at the behavior, you know, looking for a typical behavior and latch onto that and help you carry that through to find other machines and understand what happened. Because otherwise it just becomes too overwhelming to try to keep track. I mean, we all try to keep track of blogs and, you know, SANS updates and, you know, the Internet Storm Center and all these other websites that keep track of the latest exploits. And we try to read those and keep up to date, but it's just too many of them. So the best you can really do is really keep a good handle on what the modern techniques of an attacker are. Same way we in the forensic field, right? What are the modern techniques today? They'll probably differ in 6 months, not by a lot, but by some. But we all follow kind of the same behavior. We know we do certain things. We file SIG, we hash, we do keyword searching. That's a behavior. That's a process that we do. Well, attackers have the same process. You know, an attacker that is broken into a company, especially after PII, it's typically not their first time. They've done this many times, so they've gotten into habits. They have a procedure down. They have a process down. You know, they do their scanning or whatever. They find a machine. The next thing they do is the thing that worked last time and the five other times before that. So the idea is to identify that and really start focusing on that, because otherwise it's too overwhelming to try to keep track of specifically today it's the PHP, you know, exploit. Tomorrow it's, you know, a SQL injection exploit. It becomes a little too overwhelming.
Yeah. Just going back, you said previously that you do training about 60% of your time now. What kind of training are you involved in, and you know, what does BITSEC offer?
Yeah, so BITSEC is an approved training partner guidance. So we offer the whole guidance series. We're authorized, licensed from them to teach the whole entire catalog of theirs. We're one of the few ATPs, and it's quite honestly because I came from guidance, so I have quite a bit of history teaching all the different classes. Yeah. There's not many ATPs that can offer. Most of the ATPs can offer the beginning and the intermediate, but not the advanced or the expert series.
Just I think that in guidance itself at the moment, I believe there's only two people in the whole company who are actually authorized to teach every single class. So
yeah,
I just want to point out that people listening, that is quite extraordinary that you're able to do that yourself.
Yeah. So again, I give that to, you know, the years I spent at guidance, you know, offering and developing those courses. So it's certainly given me an advantage in that respect. And then we've developed our own. When we formed the company, we certainly had the ability to go into hardware and software reselling. We chose not to. And not for any particular reason. We just don't really get involved in the selling of hardware and software. What we really just decided to do, and it was really based on both of our experiences, Mike's and mine, is like all labs, we use multiple tools. So we wanted to form and create training programs that were not product specific, but more so when a client or a particular group came to us and said, we want to do training. We wanted to train on the principles, not the tool. So you might particularly use InCase. Great. We'll teach you how to do an investigation or how to do email investigations or how to do e-discovery or network intrusions with InCase. The next guy comes along and his shop uses FTK. Fine. We have a class put together that will use FTK. The curriculum is the same, except the tool is different, right? So if you understand the underlying concepts, it doesn't matter what tool you use. So what we've really tried to focus on is understanding not the clicking, not which icon to click on to get a result, but what do you need to do to get that result? Where do you need to go to look? So then it doesn't matter whether you use InCase, FDK, XWays, or a hex editor. It doesn't matter. You know where to go to get it and what it should say or what you expect it to say. And so what we try to do is develop some of our own courses, which is, you know, kind of we've developed some entry-level kind of what we call the computer forensic fundamentals, some network security, malware, network investigations, collecting live data analysis, which is, you know, collecting RAM, volatile data. We developed our own courses that are not necessarily tool-specific. We show tools, and we kind of tell you, these are our favorites, these are the ones we use, but here are the five that do kind of the same thing. So it's really up to you which one you want to use, as long as you understand the underlying concepts and the reasons why you're doing this. It really doesn't matter what tool you use. Some tools make it easier, some tools make it more difficult, or some tools are a little cleaner, some tools, the interface might be a little more friendly. But ultimately, you're just using a tool to show you information. It's up to you to interpret it. It's up to you to really look at it and know what it means. So, you know, we've developed this full series of classes, and we're adding more. We're going to be adding some Macintosh classes soon, cell phones, and some more advanced level. We're just finishing up a 2-week network intrusion course, which, again, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel of InCase, the guidance class, because I know exactly what's in that one. What I'm trying to do is take it to the next level. There's lots of things in that class there's lots of things that are missing out of that class, and that is a very InCase-specific class. So what we tried to do is create another class, or our custom class, which, again, is not tool-specific, but more so concept-driven, but takes it to the next level, which is, you know, let's get into deep log analysis. Let's get into network capturing, interpretation of network capturing. You know, let's look at firewall logs. These are all things that you're going to have to do eventually, but those are not InCase-specific things, so they're not offered in the InCase course, which rightfully so. They have nothing to do with particularly with InCase. So we've included those to kind of make it a full service, or essentially a complete class that, you know, a person just getting into the field or newly assigned into this particular field or area of network intrusion, to give them the full gamut of, you know, these are the questions you should be asking. This is your initial investigation response. Here's the tool, some tools that will help you. And then also all the way through, you know, when you ask for those firewall logs, well, let's teach you how to read them. Let's teach you how to interpret them. Teach you how to set up a sniffer, how to build one, how to deploy one, how to remotely administer one, how to collect it later or collect it remotely and analyze that for answers. Because you might have an ongoing investigation where it's still going on, so you might want to deploy some sort of network capturing device to help fortify or collect additional equipment, more so than you already have. We tried to put together some courses that are kind of as complete as possible, but again, staying away from being vendor-specific or tool-specific. We have our favorites. We've formed some you know, strategic partners. Certainly, we're an ATP for guidance. We are also, we're the first training partner for F-Response tools.
Yep.
And we have our, like I said, we have our favorites, and we do the training in those tools because those are currently the industry leaders, but those aren't the only ones we do. We pretty much offer training in all the tools, or we offer training with all the tools. It's not necessarily in those tools. We try not to teach, look, you know, click here and this is the answer you'll get. Rather, let's teach you why it's there, what's there, and how to get to it with any tool.
Very cool. Can I put you on the spot and ask you what your favorite tool of choice is then?
I would say right now my favorite tool of choice is F-Response. Okay. It's the newest. Certainly, I'm a guidance. You know, I'm an in-case user. I use many different forensic tools depending on what kind of case I'm doing, and I'm you know, I have all the different dongles sitting here right next to me. You know, my in-case dongle. I have my FTK dongle. I have my X-Ways forensics dongle. I have I2. You know, I have all these different dongles that I might use for a particular case. Day in and day out, it's typically I use in-case to do my analysis, and really F-Response. You know, it is not necessarily a forensic tool, but more so it's a conduit. It's a way to link your forensic tool to do remote forensics. And to me, it's one of those ideas and one of those things that, you know, Matt Shannon, who's the founder of that tool, you know, I look at him and I say, man, why didn't anyone else think of it? This is so simple in the concept that how could this go by for years and no one really thought of it, and certainly
you kind of kick yourself a little bit thinking why.
Yeah, you do. You go, man, this is kind of such a simple, but I really give it to him and his staff for putting it together. And you know, it for me, that's probably one of my favorite tools at the moment. It's the newest tool out in the field of the big boys, but I think it has changed and is changing the landscape of forensics, you know, quite the same way enterprise guidance, you know, in case enterprise did years ago, but certainly that was geared towards, you know, corporations, much higher price because it's geared towards you know, a full enterprise, where this can be deployed from an end forensic examiner at a very minimal price. It can't, you know, necessarily sweep 1,000 end machines quickly like enterprise can, but you may not have that particular need. So this answers that gap that has existed for quite a while. And to me, that's just one of those tools that I'm just kind of really happy that it has evolved, and I'm really happy it has come out.
We've had Matt Shannon on the show a few weeks ago, and he's just the nicest guy in the world. I think that, you know, you could call him names or whatever, and he would still just sit and smile at you back. He's just the nicest guy in the world.
He is. He really is. Many times I've had questions, or we've been working on some projects together where I've shot him an email at, you know, midnight as I'm going to sleep, or if I'm in another part of the world, and suddenly he answers me back within 2 minutes. And it's like, Matt, you know, lay off the Red Bull. You know, you got to go to sleep at some point. And no, he's very, very helpful. And, you know, I think it's proof from the evolution of his tool, how new features have been added, and the price, that he's really into this to help the community. You know, certainly he's a businessman, and like all of us, you know, we're in to make a living and we're in to make some money. But also, you know, I think it shows that he certainly is receptive and looking to help people and add features. You know, back when it didn't used to collect memory, I was having conversations with him when that idea was brought up by someone else, and then suddenly, you know, I had a beta version that was collecting memory within, you know, weeks. Suddenly, go, wow, this is great.
Fantastic. All right, well, just to quickly, on the training front, if people want to get involved and they want to take some of the training which BitSec offer, is there specific places where they can go, or do you do, like, in-house training as well?
Yeah, we've really tried to push it more towards so again, you know, companies and task forces have budgets, and certainly this year has been a bad year for budgets for government entities. So that's a good thing for us, because what we did when we formed the company is we really tried to cater not to, you know, come to us, but we'll come to you. So we've really tried to offer some courses, but really try to say, all right, you have 5-6 people in your company or your task force. What tools do you use? Okay, we use FTK as our primary and InCase as a secondary. fine, we have the curriculum, and we'll gear that curriculum specifically for FTK, and then we'll also show you the in-case way. But we'll come to you, right? Because otherwise you're paying travel and per diem for five guys to come somewhere where really all you need to do is pay for one, and that's our instructor. So we offer classes worldwide. We've traveled all over the world providing these classes. We do randomly select places, or sometimes we have an agency, a law enforcement agency, or a company that says, we want to have a class, and we have four or five people, and we're willing to open it up to the public. Well, then we'll post that class, and we'll say, look, you know, on June 16th, we're having a class in Mexico City. Anyone's available to come if they're near that location or want to travel to that location. But anyone's welcome to contact us at our website, and we certainly will discuss possibilities of coming to them to try to help minimize and reduce the cost to them and maximize their, the benefit of the training.
Very cool. All right. Well, just to finish off with, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've got coming up in the future? Anything where people can find you or...
Wow. Yeah, so I'll be kind of all over the world here in the next few months. So from a geographic location, I'll be in Mexico City for the next month, and then I'll be off to the Philippines for a month. And then I'll be in Asia, a couple different places in Asia during the summer, doing training and work, forensic work. As far as the product side, or at least the training side, as I mentioned, we've got a couple new courses coming out, that an incident response course, which is basically, you know, teaching some people kind of not necessarily entry level, but companies or organizations that want to start learning about incident response capabilities, reinforce their current capabilities or add new capabilities. So we've got kind of a full featured incident response course coming out, a Macintosh course that's going to be coming out, some malware investigation courses that will be coming out here in the next few months. And then we'll continue doing the customized, you know, courses that I described. As far as InScripts, we've got a couple in the development phases now that I think are going to be very useful. A couple of them might be some small bombs that you know will certainly I don't want to divulge too much, but certainly might help some people out quite a bit. So hopefully within the next 30 days or so, we might have some new InScripts. The one that I've been kind of developing as free time has kind of been a triage InScript. You know, there's lots of products out there right now. And again, this is nothing against them. There's some really good products out there that do some triaging to help investigators kind of get a first glance at what's on a device. And some of that, most of the people that are after that are typically your child pornography investigators, child exploitation investigators. So try to put together an InScript that gets them some quick answers and an assessment. And again, I'm not trying to compete with any standalone tools. I'm just trying to make it a little easier where they already have an image or they're already in case, so there's no reason to export anything out yet. Give them a kind of a quick assessment and a quick all-inclusive report. And for example, you know, there are five user accounts on this machine. These user accounts have accessed these documents in the last 30 days or 60 days, whatever you specify. These images, or there are X number of images in this person's profile, X number of graphics in this person's profile. So it'd be something you'd click on, let it run for 60 seconds. It would come back, and it's really for low-hanging fruit, right? It's to kind of just give you that 60-second glance while you went to go get some coffee. It cost you nothing. It took no time, same amount of time, you know, you stepped away to go get coffee. When you get back, you can at least look at it. If there's nothing there, you're going to go do what you were already going to go do. But the idea is at least to give you the low-hanging fruit so that that's your starting point. You know, if there's something in the report that catches your eye, you can say, okay, I'm going to go start there. I'm going to go look at that and see where that leads me. So that should be coming out here very soon. By summertime, we hope to have a beta or a public version that is usable. So we've got quite a few things this year. I think you know that will benefit kind of all the different aspects of the training side. The working examiners that just want another tool or another InScript to help expedite their workflow.
Fantastic. So where can people find you? What your blog address?
So my blog address is forensickkb.com. That originally started, I got that domain because I originally started out, I was going to put a wiki, and I thought forensickkb, meaning knowledge base. So I registered that domain, and as I played with wiki software, none of it was really answering what I wanted. That was kind of back when blogs were just starting to become popular, and I decided to make a blog, and it kind of stuck. So the address for the blog is forensickkb.com. The company, BitSec Forensics, BITSEC Forensics.com, all one word. And my email address is lance@bitsecforensics.com or lance@forensickkb.com.
Cool.
And I'm very accessible. As I mentioned, my email address is right on my front of my blog. And, people send me emails almost every day. I'm pretty quick about answering every email. Even if I can't help, I at least acknowledge. So people have questions or ideas. I posted a blog a while, maybe 6 months ago about, what if you could have any InScript in the world, what would you want? And I got some interesting, some interesting ideas, and some of those have evolved. But if people have ideas, feel free to shoot it out, and I'll give you all the credit in the world for coming up with the idea. My interest really, if I have a skill to help that idea come to life, then sure, I'll help.
Fantastic. All right, well, thanks for your time today. We really appreciate it. And
yeah, no worries at all. I like I said, I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
All right, well, thank you very much for spending your valuable time talking to us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, and we'll catch you later.
All right, take care.
Okay, so that was the interview with Lance Mueller. You'll notice it's a little bit quieter than the rest of the podcast. It's because I've found out some interesting things about recording in the last couple of weeks. So this bit, our talking now is going to be a bit louder than the interview. And obviously the bit before the interview was as well. But yeah, as we've wasted enough of your time today, well, hopefully you haven't wasted it, but you spent enough time with us, we'd just like to just leave you with the funny story of the week, which Simon's going to provide to us. And what interesting tidbit of information did you find out this week, Simon?
Well, sometimes you read these and you just think, I'm not really sure I believe what I'm reading, but the headline for this one obviously caught my attention. It's budget airline plans standing tickets. A Chinese budget airline has applied for permission to sell cut price standing room only tickets. You got to think there's issues with that.
I'm just picturing the takeoff and landing. Yeah. Class. Go on. Sorry.
The vice president of the company involved said that for a lower price, passengers should be able to get on a plane like catching a bus with no seat, no luggage consignment, no food, no water, but very convenient. Possibly for a short haul flight. Can you imagine if someone sold standing only tickets from a flight across the Atlantic? You'd feel like you were never going to sit down for the rest of your life.
That's fantastic. There's a budget airline over here that I know that charges for you taking any baggage on, and even for using the toilet. But
can you imagine if next time you went to, you said no thanks, I'll just stand, please, if that'll be cheaper.
It's an extra 200 quid if you sit down. Oh well, yeah. I'm going to stand up then. All right, just hold on to this while we take off. Yeah. I can just see in my mind's eye all these people tumbling to the back of the plane.
There's all sorts of issues, isn't there? I mean, you'd have to keep track of the number of... It's not like a train. I mean, for a start, a train is on the ground, and so you can pack it fairly full, and people don't need life vests or anything else.
And you're not approaching, 2Gs or 1G or whatever else, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
I can't see that working, but if someone wants to try it and if people are mad enough to pay for a standing-only ticket on a plane, then they can do what they like.
The other thing is that planes have to be balanced. They have to be equally balanced, don't they?
Yeah. There's just so many things wrong with that. But I just... I thought it was staggering when I read that.
Amazing. All right. Well, only in China, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you try to look up anything about it, obviously you won't be able to find it on google.cn because it would have been blocked. But
that's controversial.
Well, I can only imagine that we were probably blocked as well. Oh, dear.
Yeah, probably.
Anyway, thank you for joining us again, and hopefully you'll get to hear from us again soon, if that's the kind of thing you like. But all right, we'll catch you later. Bye for now.